This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thank you.
Jade Gulliver presents a collection of podcast interviews about podcasts and media makers. Welcome to the Podcraft.
This is episode 2 of the Podcraft. My name is Jade Gulliver. My guest today is America's radio sweetheart, host of The Sound of Young America, and one half of Jordan Jesse Go, Jesse Thorne. Thanks so much for doing this, because I just absolutely love The Sound of Young America, and I am one of the late adopters, and I'll admit to being one of those. And I've just actually started listening to Jordan Jesse Go as well. But what I wanted to ask you was, you're always referring to yourself as America's radio sweetheart. Is this similar to when George on Seinfeld was trying to get everyone to call him T-Bone?
Yeah, it's not dissimilar. I mean, the premise of it was when we started The Sound of Young America, it wasn't just me.
Yeah.
So we had two other hosts, Jordan Morris, Boy Detective, who does Jordan Jesse Go with me now, and our friend Gene Big Time O'Neill. And just like calling the show The Sound of Young America when we were just like yokels in college, we thought we would make up ridiculous names for ourselves as well.
And why did you go with America's Radio Sweetheart?
Well, maybe you don't agree. I think it has kind of a nice ring to it, don't you?
And that's how you get known the world over now?
You know, most of the reaction I get to it is the occasional person who listens to me on the radio who will send me an email and say something like, "You're not America's radio sweetheart. How dare you call yourself that?" And then I have to email them back and say, "Yes, I agree. It is a joke."
And they'll name the person who is actually America's radio sweetheart?
Yeah, it's usually Ira Glass, host of This American Life, which, hey,
that's a good choice.
I was going to pick America's, but hey, he's my radio hero, so there you go.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that The Sound of Young America was initially a quite a different show when you had two co-hosts, but now it's primarily interview-based. When Jordan and Gene weren't around anymore, how long did it sort of take you to find your own style for the show?
Oh, gosh, it was really terrifying. Gene and I graduated from college, and Jordan was a year behind us. And I kept doing the show with Jordan at our college radio station after I had graduated. Gene moved away to Southern California. And so I had this year where Jordan was still in school, even though I wasn't. And then Jordan graduated from school, and I realized it was just me. And the first thing I did was book a bunch of random people to be sort of the sit-in co-host with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that wasn't really sustainable. And you know, we had done all this, we had done kind of comedy bits and call-in bits and stuff like that on the show before, and I realized that I just couldn't do those things by myself. I mean, there's this, doing comedy by yourself in general is pretty much impossible. It's really difficult to, it's just really difficult to know what's funny when there's no one else there to laugh.
Yeah.
And so I sort of jettisoned that part of the show and stuck with what I knew would fill my hour a week, which was two interviews instead of one. And it pretty much became an interview show. I mean, since then, we do other stuff on the show sometimes, the occasional sort of commentary or a sketch from a sketch group or something like that. But
yeah.
Generally speaking, it became an interview show as soon as I realized I had to go solo. In fact, you could even say that me making it an interview show was a way of avoiding being a solo performer.
I guess one of the things I really love about the show is that you consistently come up with really great guests, and they've got, you know, varying degrees of fame. Like, you know, you have Jeffrey Tambor or, you know, Jenna Fisher from The Office, but then you also have, you know, these people who have written really obscure books and stuff, but they're actually really interesting people. How difficult was it in the beginning, though, to sort of get people interested in coming on the show?
I mean, it's still really difficult to get people interested in coming on the show. Like, we're on the radio now, and when I say we, I guess I'm referring to me and my intern, Brian, and my one-day-a-week editor, Nick. So we are on the radio now in New York and Philadelphia and San Francisco, which is three of the top five media markets in the United States. But it's still tough to get people to come on the show. In the olden days, we would work really hard to try and get people who we could get to directly. And, you know, even now, a lot of stand-up comics, for example, have their direct email address on their website. And we would just email them and say, would you come on our show? And we were doing it by phone then. It's a little easier to get somebody to come in by phone. And we would just kind of, we would just try and act really professional. So it seemed like almost a foregone conclusion that they were going to agree to come on the show. And I think there's a certain extent to which, unless you're really following what is an important news outlet and what isn't, unless you're like, you know, a huge national magazine, unless you're The Economist or Time or something like that, mm-hmm. or you're ABC or, in that case, I was referring to the American Broadcast Corporation, but I could have just as well been referring to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah.
Like, unless you're that level where everyone knows who you are, the main way that people can tell the difference between you and between a big thing and a little thing is like how professional they seem.
Mm-hmm.
So we just try to like have like a website that made us look important and write really clear emails asking people on the show and speak in a deep voice on the phone when we had to, you know, call someone to book someone on the show. And we also like, as you said, the varying degrees of fame thing is very much the case. Like, it's never been my goal to book the most famous guests on the show that I could.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do have is really credible guests who do really incredible work. And you know, I can book Jenna Fischer because I can tell her that, or I can tell her people that, you know, Bill Hader or David Cross has been on the show. Somebody that's, you know, within the comedy world, spectacularly well-regarded, even if they're not that famous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a combination of that and also just kind of low-level, allow people to believe what they want to believe about how important we are, deception.
So basically from here on out, I should be saying I've had Jesse Thorne on my show and that should be all the credibility I need.
Oh, no. Do not tell anyone you've had Jesse Thorne on your show. It will blow all your credibility, especially if they know who I am. Can I ask you a question about fame?
Yeah, sure.
I have heard that my friends, comedian Arj Barker and comedian Maria Bamford, are very famous comedians in Australia. Is that true?
Yes, they're huge. Arj in particular is huge in Australia.
That is amazing because you couldn't find a bigger Arj Barker fan than me. We're both San Franciscans. He grew up in Marin County in California, which is where my wife grew up. You know, I love Arj, but very, very not famous in the United States. I'm so happy that he has a nation where he can be famous.
Because, you know, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is on at the moment, so we're all very bombarded by comedians at the moment, and he is definitely one of the ones that gets a lot of attention down here.
That's fantastic. Well, I think the world of him. More power to him, says yeah. I. Sorry, I derailed the entire conversation.
No. I'm sure that everyone is really excited that we mentioned Arj Barker, and maybe that is my varying degrees of fame mentioned that will get me listeners.
Arj Barker has been a guest on The Sound of Young America.
The Sound of Young America, the visual that I love is that it's recorded in your house. And I don't want you to ruin that if it isn't. Okay.
No, it is. I got an email the other day from someone. At the top of every show, I say, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America.
Yeah.
Which I saw as sort of a combination of an homage to the classic introduction to the Larry Sanders Show, but also just a way of introducing people to the idea that it's taped in my house. And I got an email from somebody the other day who said that they had always assumed that my house was the name of like a hip recording studio, when actually it is very literally the case. I mean, what I really taped the show in my, I mean, house is even an overstatement. It's an apartment in a big apartment building in Los Angeles. So I used to do it in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I really started moving up in the world, I got a second bedroom. And now I have a special room just for it being my office slash my intern's office slash my recording studio. So yeah, like when I have a guest on the show, I go down and meet them at the front gate and take them up in the old-timey elevator in my building, and we walk into my apartment and they say, oh, this really is in your apartment.
Yeah, I just love that idea that it's like, hey, come over to my house and we'll do an interview.
I try not to push that too much. My wife said to me, you know, Jesse, especially for lady guests, that could be kind of creepy. And it had never occurred to me before. Like, I'm embarrassed to say, but it had never occurred to me that it would be kind of creepy for me to be like, hey, come over to my house and be on my radio show. But it totally is, and now I'm really self-conscious about it. But, like, generally speaking, the guests are happy, and they feel welcomed. And for the kind of show that I do, you know, the kind of interviews that I do are very very kind of intimate in a way, and I think that very casual and personal. And I think that you know, if I'm welcoming someone into my home, for the most part, that helps the interview. And it definitely helps that I don't have to own or rent space in a recording studio because I couldn't afford that.
Or you can just, you know, convince some community radio station to let you record out of their station the way I have.
Harder than you know.
Speaking of your guests, you have, I have mentioned that you have great guests, but how do you actually decide on a guest? Because I know that, I mean, working at Joy, we get a lot of people just kind of bombarding us with press releases and all kinds of stuff, but you seem to have a very specific focus on making sure that you get people that aren't necessarily pushing a product.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The extent to which I am not bombarded with press releases always surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at this point, you know, there's college radio promoters who are pushing bands on me a lot via email, but that was not always the case. And I mean, that was, you know, college radio promoters were promoting to me when I was in college and didn't have any audience at all. So for a national radio show, I'm not the target of a lot of media interest.
Mm-hmm.
Or public relations interest. I think ultimately, like, the criterion for being on my show is that I think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a sort of secondary criterion, which is I figure if I'm on the radio in a lot of different places, if I interview somebody, they should, and they're being interviewed because they make a thing, then that thing should be available to people across the country. So, you know, if I'm interviewing a band, I want to interview a band that has a CD that people could go buy. Or
mm-hmm.
If it's a comedian, I would like them to have a CD or a special that people can watch. Something that, you know, no matter where you don't have to live in New York or Los Angeles to enjoy it. So that's the only other qualification. So basically, almost all the guests that are on my show are guests that weren't pitched to me, but rather I went out and booked. And that's really hard and annoying and tiresome, and it's not a lot of fun. It's definitely the worst part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the best part of my job is that I get to pick who the guests on my show are. So, you know, I'm not really in a position to complain. I mean, I've been, just for example, I spent a bunch of time today trying to book the creators of the Canadian television show, The Trailer Park Boys, which, I don't know, it's probably aired on TV in Australia.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
It's huge in Canada. It has basically barely aired on TV at all here in the United States. But it's really fantastic. And it's actually very big in Israel, I read on the internet. But here in the United States, like, you have to have a particular cable satellite provider, and it's on this channel that's owned by the cable satellite provider. It's like on demand or something. I don't even know. It's really weird. But I think this show is really, really great and hilarious. I think it's one of the best, you know, comedy TV shows in the world. So, you know, I'm jumping through a bunch of hoops to try and get these guys who live in Toronto to do an interview with this public radio station in the United States, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And basically most of my guests come that way. Like, they mostly come because there's something that I think is really great, And so I go out and beat the bushes to try and get them onto my show.
When I've listened to a couple of shows, I mean, what you were saying earlier about making sure that it's available to everyone, there's been times when I've listened to your show and then afterwards I've gone, oh, that they sound really cool, and I'll go out and look for it. And if I manage to find it here, then, you know, I think that means that, I mean, Aqua Teen, Hunger Force is probably an example. I hadn't really heard anything else about it. And I went out and bought the DVD. Or then, you know, I just started listening to Studio 360 after Kurt Anderson was on the show the other day. So
I really like the idea that one of the big things about The Sound of Young America is that while you may not have heard of every one of my guests, mm-hmm. you can, if you trust my judgment, then you can trust my judgment. So I hear a lot from listeners who tell me, I was such a huge fan of whoever it is. Often it's not even one of the more famous people who've been on my show, but they might say, I was such a huge fan of, say, Jim Gaffigan, who's a stand-up comic here in the United States. And mm-hmm. and I heard this interview that you did with him on your show. I thought it was so great. And then I started listening to other episodes, and it was people that I hadn't necessarily heard of. But now I'm as big a fan of them as I was of Jim Gaffigan. And so sort of I see part of my job as being almost like a curator, and picking things that I think are great without exception. So I don't pick people just because they're famous or just because they would get me a lot of audience or anything like that. Like, I really try and focus on getting people who make something that's really great and that people would enjoy if they pursued it. And my hope is that if I'm consistent with that, then it's less important whether the people who are on my show are incredibly famous. And some of them are kind of famous, but, you know, and I have nothing against people who are famous, but it's nice to know that I could book somebody who nobody's ever heard of if I actually think they're really great.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I was trying to think back to who actually drew my attention to the show, and I think it was when you had Ira Glass from The Sound of Young America from This American Life on.
Yeah, well, that was a really big show for me.
And, yeah.
You know, the This American Life has been such a big part of my life for the 10 years, more than 10 years, I guess, at this point, that it's been on the radio. And you know, I think if it weren't for This American Life, I don't think I would have pursued a career in public radio here in the United States. And it's not because my show is, despite the fact that they both have America in the name, mm-hmm. my show like couldn't be more different than This American Life in terms of format. But and I've never wanted to make a This American Life like thing. Mm-hmm. But what it really was that This American Life, I think, is representative of my aesthetic taste in a way that a lot of other public radio isn't necessarily, and the idea that a show like that could be very successful was really inspirational to me. I've always really admired Ira, so when I emailed him and he not only agreed to come on my show, but he had heard my show before, mm-hmm. I mean, it was really like I was really blown away. I was really amazed by that. He's totally a hero of mine. Like, I've met him in real life, and like even meeting him in real life, like, I'm still like, whoa. It was Ira Glass. Of course, he made fun of me the minute he came on my show. He made fun of me for booking like every single regular contributor to This American Life on my show. And then, well, you know, I probably think they're cool for the same reasons you do, Ira.
Yeah, I actually really liked listening back to all of the other This American Life contributors. I think it's really interesting.
Well, I got an email recently from Sarah Vowell, who's a regular contributor to This American Life, about how much she enjoys listening to the show on WNYC in New York,
yeah.
Which is where This American Life is based these days. Mm-hmm. And, man, it was just really neat. It was just really cool because, you know, the This American Life team are, you know, mostly 10 to 15 years older than me. And so, like, they really were the vanguard and continue to be the vanguard. I mean, they continue to make amazing stuff. So, you know, it would be difficult to overstate the extent to which I admire the work they've done.
Just to get back onto your guests, who have you wanted to have on to your show and not had them either say no or you haven't been able to get them because you can't get through their people?
Oh, gosh. Who doesn't fall into that category? There's millions. One, I mean, you know, and they're not all super, super famous. I mean, Randy Newman is somebody that I've always wanted to have on the show and have really worked hard on a couple of occasions to try and get on the show and have just completely failed. I mean, he's, you know, the guy is like 65 and super rich from writing the score to a million movies, not so much from his singer-songwriter career. And he just doesn't really care to do that much press anymore. And there's just millions. I mean, lately I've really been trying to talk Kristen Wiig's management into letting me interview her. She's a regular on Saturday Night Live and has just an amazing genius of comedy, just a really, really brilliant comedian. But she's kind of quiet and doesn't really feel comfortable doing interviews. And she's in New York, you know, so I would probably put her in a studio in New York. But, you know, for a lot of comedians, like when they do broadcast interviews, the hosts often just sort of like figure they can just wind them up and they'll be funny and entertain people for 20 minutes or however long they're on.
Mm-hmm.
And so for comedians who are quiet, that's just a lot of pressure because they, you know, have finally honed acts that they're not going to perform. They're not just, you know, the kind of people that just burst into a room making people laugh. Actually, there's this comedian, Mike Birbiglia, who has a really great line about how he wasn't the class clown and most comedians weren't the class clown. He was sort of a quiet guy who sat in the back, and the class clown, if he was a comedian, would be like, "You're fat, you're gay, I'm out of here." Like, I think basically that level of performance is what a lot of broadcast interviewers expect out of comedians, so it's tough for them. But, I mean, there's millions of people. I mean, there's so many people that I would love to have on The Sound of Young America who are too famous or too tough to get to, or, you know, I mean, there's people who are really famous that I would love to have on The Sound of Young America. I mean, I love Will Ferrell.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to have Will Ferrell on The Sound of Young America. I don't really think it's in the cards. I mean, of all the people in the world, if I could pick one person to be on The Sound of Young America, it would be David Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even do interviews.
Yeah.
You know, he's done, in the past 15 years, he's done, you know, 5 or 6 interviews.
Wasn't he on Oprah?
Yeah, he was on Oprah once. He was on Nightline with Ted Koppel once. He did something for Rolling Stone twice. And, like, that's about it. So I have to. Instead of interviewing him, I'll have to settle for watching him be interviewed by American sports casting legend Howard Cosell on Howard Cosell's weird late night talk show from the mid 1980s.
It's funny you mentioned about comedians not feeling comfortable with coming and doing an interview, because here in Melbourne in particular, but also around Australia, there are a lot of comedians who are also breakfast radio hosts.
Oh.
And so they spend all of their time, you know, entertaining. And they, I find it interesting when you go to see them live, they actually do rehash some of the stuff that they've said on their radio show. So you kind of get, you know, like, you sit there and you're like, I've heard this already. I heard this, you know, 2 days ago. So it's interesting to see how they work their material into a radio show format.
It's interesting to me the way that that radio as a medium is much more legitimate in other countries than it is here in the United States. But just generally speaking, I mean, I think it must be that in order to make a living as a stand-up comic in the United States, you have to tour over a much greater physical distance than you might in a lot of other places. And so it's very difficult to maintain both a broadcasting schedule and a performance schedule, unless you're so famous that you know, you can make a lot of money flying in and doing a single night somewhere. You know, like a Jay Leno who hosts The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
He does these $100,000 stand-up comedy gigs where he like flies in on a private helicopter, does an hour of comedy, and then flies out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's weird. Like there's all these wonderful British comics who have radio shows in England. And there are no comics on the radio in the United States. There are a few funny radio personalities, but they're sort of discreet. They're sort of discreet professions in a way that that they're not in other countries. Like, radio is not a step on the way to television in the United States. Radio is where you go if you're already a failure at television.
Well, I mean, I don't know that much about. I have spent some time in the U.S., but I don't know that much about the way that radio presenters are treated there. But I know that here, like, you know, the comedians that are on breakfast radio or whatever have get huge billboards made about their show, and you know, are really highly publicized and famous for being,
a radio host. Morning Drive, as they call it here, radio is certainly big business.
Yeah.
But there's the people who do it tend to be broadcasters and not comics. I mean, they're maybe funny broadcasters or not funny broadcasters, but they have a very specific skill, and they don't tend to do stage performances. Although I will say that there's this guy here in the United States who hosts a really a really extreme right wing sort of opinion TV news show on the Fox News Channel named Glenn Beck.
Okay.
You know, he's just always complaining about immigrants or whatever.
I think I've seen him on the Daily Show before.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So Glenn Beck, who's like this really right-wing jerk, whose business is being a right-wing jerk, is about to go on a stand-up comedy tour, which has completely blown my mind. Apparently, the theme of the stand-up comedy tour has something to do with him dressing up as George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or something like that. I don't really understand what's going on with that. But there is one example of a broadcaster going on stand-up comedy tour.
I guess with what I find really fascinating about podcasting and the podcast the idea of podcasters in general is that you have to have a lot of interaction with your audience. What is it that you enjoy about actually, you know, people emailing you out of the blue, and you know, you've got obviously got a forum on the Sound of Young America website, and you know, sort of encouraging that interaction, and you know, I follow you on Twitter, and you're always, you know, writing on Twitter and getting responses that way. You know, how's that?
It started because when you're on the radio,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to get people to call in. And anytime you're doing something, anytime you're performing, it's very difficult to perform without an audience. And I think radio, in a way, is like the most alienating in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
You're just desperate for anyone to tell you that they're even listening, much less that they enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of started out that way. But there's a much different relationship with the audience on the internet than there is on the audience on the radio. I think there's just sort of an expectation of community and of, if I might be permitted to use a computer buzzword from 1992, interactivity.
Yeah.
I feel like I should be wearing virtual reality goggles when I say the word interactivity. There's an expectation that it's a two-way street on the internet, that there isn't in mass media, or in broadcast media. I'm fine with that. I mean, I give out my actual email address on the show,
mm-hmm.
and I don't get like an unmanageable number of emails. I get a few a day from listeners,
mm-hmm.
And I'm usually happy to get them. And I feel bad because I've gotten to the point where I get enough emails that like I can't give a thoughtful response to everyone who emails me, and so I'm worried that people will think I'm a jerk and I'm ignoring them when in fact I've just read their email. I just don't have time to get back to them. And, you know, that's a worry. Like, I don't want people to assume that I'm a jerk. But besides that, it's mostly a pleasure. I mean, sometimes people email me to complain or say something mean. But usually one thing is that if you say, this is my actual email address,
mm-hmm.
Most people are scared to go up to somebody and say to their face, you suck.
Yeah.
And that works out to my favor. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I participate actively on my forum, for example. Like, I think there's a much, you'll get much less baloney on a forum where people are posting things and they know the guy that they're posting about will see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might be critical, but they're not going to be a jerk about it. And so I just try and kind of be visible and participate and have a two-way relationship the best I can. Ultimately, I think because, you know, for one thing, I enjoy it and I get a lot of good input from it. But also just because I kind of see that as being part of my job, you know. I think at this, the way the media world is right now, you know, you have to provide people with a richer relationship than just me spitting something at them. And, you know, maybe it'll be a slightly smaller audience that you can do that for, but that audience will care more. And, you know, that's what ultimately, you know, that's ultimately why I can pay my rent. I mean, I make a small portion of the amount of money that I use to pay my rent from being on the radio. Being on the public radio in the United States, you have to put together a pretty huge network of stations before you start actually making enough money to eat, much less pay other people.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my revenue comes from listeners on the internet directly, and, you know, I think it's reasonable for them to expect to have some kind of relationship with me when they're sending me money that they don't have to send me.
Speaking of spending money on it, I was reading the other day, I think I was actually listening to a podcast also about how they're saying, you know, maybe we're going to have to start charging for, you know, free use of newspapers on the internet, and, you know, we're going to have to start more. Do you feel like that, you know, by you kind of already having that system in place, it's going to be a lot easier if that becomes the prevalent thing to do, to actually, is that a viable option?
I feel like I have set up what I'm doing with the idea that I'll give it away whenever I can.
Mm-hmm.
All the movie studios are suing people who are downloading their movies from BitTorrent.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, put up all of my shows on BitTorrent,
mm-hmm.
and feed them myself.
Yeah.
So that anybody who wants to donate, who wants to download all of my shows for free from BitTorrent can. And the reason I do that is basically because I think having a better relationship with more people is more important to me than selling something to people. I think that what I'm ultimately selling to people is this whole world that I produce, and they're going to be able to choose whether they give me money or not anyway. So I might as well not try and fight it and instead embrace it. And so, yeah, so I give everything away and just hope that when I ask people for donations that they will donate. And while right now only a small percentage of my listeners donate, it is nonetheless enough for me to, you know, eat and pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really in a position to complain about it. I mean, if I started charging for my thing, like, could I make more money from it? Maybe in the short term. I don't see a great long-term growth pattern with that, though. So, you know, I feel really good about what I'm doing right now because, you know, ultimately it's, you know, the reason I do this thing is to reach people. It's not because I want to get rich.
Yeah.
So if my value is I want to reach people, you know, I want to share things that I think are great with people, I want to entertain people, I want to do whatever, then the best way to do that is, you know, give it away as freely and widely as I can.
Do you find that the difference between radio and podcasting, or having it out there into the world, is probably more of an opportunity for you to do that? Because...
Yeah, well, I mean, I started doing this because I wanted to be on the radio, and I still love and want to be on the radio. I basically am completely platform and technology agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm happy to reach people with what I'm doing however I can. And, you know, here in the United States, I know that, you know, almost 100% of people have radios, and I think the average number of radios in a household is like 8 or 9. And, you know, only maybe 5% of adults listen to podcasts. So I'm so happy to be on the radio and so happy that I get some money from that. But, you know, I'm so happy to be on the podcast as well. I'm happy to reach people however I can.
Did you know that you have a Wikipedia page?
I do know that I had a Wikipedia page because there was a big fight over whether I was good enough to be included in Wikipedia. And somebody emailed me about it, and then I had to go in there onto the comments of it and post that I met the Wikipedia standards, which is like you have to be mentioned in 3 press something. I don't know. But whatever it was, I was good enough, but I had to prove it with links.
I think I always look on Wikipedia to decide, you know, whether that means that you've made it. And if you've made it to Wikipedia, then you've made it, I think.
Well, at least an alternate way of looking at it is, if you've made it to Wikipedia, then you've made it with nerds who edit Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. I love the idea.
And I don't mean that as a put down to nerds who edit Wikipedia either.
I love the idea that someone cared enough to put an entry up in the first place,
Gosh, isn't that amazing? I mean, but you know, also, I mean, I was just the other day, I couldn't remember what was the last episode of the new Battlestar Galactica that I had watched.
Yeah.
And so I went on Wikipedia because I figured there would be an episode guide. And like the, I guess you'll pardon the pun, encyclopedic depth of the information about Battlestar Galactica blew me away and reminded me that in the ecosystem of nerd culture, I'm a very, 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 very minor, if I can mix metaphors, cog in the machine.
I'm a huge fan of the X-Files, and I like to think of myself as an internal Wikipedia for X-Files, but I always know that if I ever forget something, I can go to Wikipedia and someone has put way too much effort into, like, identifying the intricate details of every single episode.
Yeah, and I couldn't necessarily say the same of some shows that I am a huge fan of, like, say, Larry Sanders. Like,
yeah.
The Larry Sanders Show, if I'm lucky, I'll get, you know, a cast list and, you know, one screen's worth of information.
Well, thank you very much, Jesse, for being on the Podcraft. You've got 2 live shows which are coming up, which I find fascinating. How is it different to do a live show, and what can we expect? And will you come to Australia to do one?
If somebody pays for me to come to Australia to do one, I will totally come to Australia to do one, but somebody's got to foot the bill.
I heard Arj Barker might pay for you.
Yeah, I'll just come out in Arj's luggage or something like that. I'll get the Bammer to bring me. You know what? I do both Jordan Jesse Go and The Sound of Young America Live. They're very sort of different experiences. With The Sound of Young America Live, we try and have some music acts and some comedy acts, and then I do some interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really fun, but I'm not much of a, you know, I don't have any writers. I don't do comedy at the top of the show or anything like that. So that's sort of like that's sort of a dry job, and it's really fun to meet the people who want to come out and see the show, and we always have great people on the show, and I really love to see them perform and interview them, but it's a little bit less of a creative experience. When I do Jordan Jesse Go, which is kind of comedy talk show,
mm-hmm.
Doing that kind of comedy, being extemporaneously comedic, or hopefully comedic, in front of a live audience, it's just the most fun you can possibly have. I mean, it's just so fun. And because of the nature of our fame, which is to say that it's very, very small, but very, very deep, the people who come out to our show come out because they want to see us, so we don't have to deal with unpleasant, hostile crowds. And, you know, we can just go and do our silly stuff, and people really like it. And it's just they're just the greatest pleasure. You know, I'm up there with my best pal, and we're just goofing around and saying stupid stuff, and people really like it and are laughing and, you know, want to buy us a drink afterwards or whatever. Like, that's such a joy.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully one day we'll be able to do it. We'll be able to do it and make big bucks. But, you know, as it stands right now, it pays for our plane tickets and that kind of thing. And, like, that's pretty great, too.
Well, thanks very much, Jesse, for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you, Jade. It was a lot of fun.
To find out more about the Sound of Young America podcast or Jordan Jesse Go, you can go to MaximumFun.org or your preferred podcast catcher.
Thanks for listening to another Joycast of the Podcraft. For more great Joycasts and the show blog, check out joy.org.au/thepodcraft. The Podcraft is produced by Jade Gulliver, audio assistance by David Lim. Thanks to the support of Joy members and sponsors. To support the station, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.